Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Confidential Information and Client Relationships in the Financial Services Industry. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to attendees in the following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn things over to Scott Humphrey. You may now begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning, everyone, depending on who you are. As she just announced, my name is Scott Humphrey, and I'm here along with Marcus Mentz and Eric Wybus. We are partners at Safar Shaw, who focus and specialize in trade secrets and non-competes, and specifically those two issues and how their interplay is with the financial services industry. And so today we're going to speak with you about protecting confidential information client relationships in the financial services industry. As the moderator announced, we will be fielding questions during the presentation, so please use the Q&A, but we will wait till the end of the presentation to then answer all those at once. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, it makes sense to start off with, basically what is a trade secret, and Marcus Mentz will go through that, and then we'll move into practical steps financial services can implement in order to protect those trade secrets, which naturally mean that you'll also want to protect the client relationships that those trade secrets help generate and then keep and retain. We'll then move on to what you should do if a federal member takes your trade secrets or violates, non-competition agreements, NDAs, confidentiality agreements. And finally, the interplay between trade secret and non-compete law in the legal setting and the court system, and with that interplay with FINRA, and most notably, the protocol for broker recruiting, which has had some interesting developments in the last 3 to 4 months. So that's our lovely picture that I won't spend any more time on. And with that, I will turn it over to Marcus Mentz.
Hi, hello, everyone. So as Scott Humphrey said, the first thing that we're going to cover today is what is a trade secret? And in one of the more frequently cited Seventh Circuit cases, the court said it's one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. But the first place that we start is frequently the Uniform Trade Secret Act. The Uniform Trade Secret Act applies in 48 states, so in virtually all but two jurisdictions in the United States. In Massachusetts, one of the two where it hasn't yet been adopted, there's a bill pending, and that leaves New York, which has common law, which is very similar to the Uniform Trade Secret Act. So what does the Uniform Trade Secret Act provide? Well, it provides us with a uniform definition of a trade secret, and then provides criteria for achieving trade secret status. As well, the Uniform Trade Secret Act defines misappropriation of trade secrets and identifies who can be liable for trade secret misappropriation. So here is a slide that provides the formal definition of what a trade secret is. And while this is helpful and it's quoted in our briefing and so on, as a practical matter and in simpler terms, a trade secret is fundamentally something that is secret, and it's something that's kept secret. So what does it mean to be a secret in the trade secret context? Well, it's got to be information that is not generally known in the industry, and it's got to be something that gives a competitive edge. It can't be reverse engineered by a competitor except with significant investment of time, effort, and expense. And when we're talking about reverse engineering, we're not just talking about a piece of tangible technology or a product. This can be true for a compilation of information, such as a customer list. If a customer list is something that was put together and maintained secret and can't be compiled through, say, a public database, telephone book, well, that might be a trade secret. If, on the other hand, someone can take information and readily put it together themselves without too much time, effort, or expense, well, then it would lose trade secret status. What does it mean to keep something secret? Well, what is required is that someone that is claiming information is a trade secret must take specific affirmative steps to keep information secret. And the Uniform Trade Secret Act says that those steps must be reasonable under the circumstances. And so what reasonable under the circumstances means is that the bigger, the more sophisticated the trade secret holder, the more a court is going to expect from them in terms of keeping information secret. What their computer systems look like, are things kept under lock and key? And similarly, if we're talking about a smaller company with less resources, the expectations are going to be correspondingly less. So in addition to the Uniform Trade Secret Act, as of 2016, there is the Defend Trade Secret Act, which is a federal statute which creates a private right of action for the misappropriation of trade secrets. The DTSA is fundamentally equivalent to the Uniform Trade Secret Act. They're very similar. Pleading a claim under the DTSA is fundamentally the same as pleading a claim under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Proving a claim under the DTSA is fundamentally the same as under the Uniform Trade Secret Act. Something that, what the DTSA does provide as a practical matter is federal jurisdiction for claims of misappropriation. So when the parties don't otherwise have another way to get into federal court, such as diversity jurisdiction or another federal claim, the DTSA provides the ability for a plaintiff to file a lawsuit in a federal court. So as I said before, both the Uniform Trade Secret Act and the DTSA, the Defend Trade Secret Act, are fundamentally the same. And proving misappropriation under either statute requires, first the existence of a trade secret, and then the unconsented disclosure or misuse of a trade secret by either someone who used improper means to acquire the secret, such as hacking into a computer system, or someone who had lawful access to the information, but then took the information from that system without the consent or right to do so. And similarly, someone who receives information that's a trade secret, when they know or should know that this information is belongs to someone else and is a trade secret, can also be liable. So you bring a claim for trade secret misappropriation, and what are the potential remedies you can get? Well, first is injunctive relief, which is often the remedy that we see most frequently sought. And injunctive relief can take a couple different forms, but a couple of the most important are getting an order from a court seeking return of the trade secret information, as well as an injunction prohibiting any further use or disclosure of the information. And even in the instance where we believe that information might be threatened with disclosure, an injunction preventing the threatened disclosure of trade secret information can be obtained as well. Monetary damages can also be obtained. These can be actual damages, where the losses caused by misappropriation. Unjust enrichment, which can be the disgorgement of monetary benefits, and in rare circumstances, a reasonable royalty where the other categories of damages, such as unjust enrichment or actual losses, are unavailable. In some cases, there can also be recovery of punitive damages as well as attorney's fees in the event that a party can show willful and malicious misappropriation, which generally means that the party that took the information did it knowingly or with conscious disregard of the trade secret owner's rights. But the cautionary note is that claims brought in bad faith, the court can award attorney's fees to the defendant in those circumstances. So what's a little bit different about the DTSA than the Uniform Trade Secret Act is that there's specific whistleblower protection. And the DTSA provides immunity to individuals under both federal or state trade secret law if they disclose information to a government official or to an attorney for the sole purpose of reporting or investigating a suspected violation of law, or if they disclose such information in a lawsuit or other proceeding, provided that the trade secret information is filed under seal. There is also a notice requirement under the DTSA that says any agreement entered into after the statute was enacted May 11, 2016, requires that there be an immunity notice language that essentially provides that a person can disclose information that's a trade secret under to a government official or attorney, like we talked about before. And the practical consequences of not providing the notice are that a trade secret holder that brings a claim under the DTSA will lose their right to recover exemplary punitive damages or attorney's fees. So trade secrets can cover a wide variety of different types of information. We provided in this slide just some examples of what certain types of trade secrets might look like. Broadly speaking, this can be customer information, client information. By internal modeling documents, we're talking about strategies, processes, the internal mechanics of a company that provides them an edge over competitors, as well as internal opportunities and trends. These are future plans, investment targets, what a company plans to do, their future business plans. So again, provided that the information is kept confidential and there's a competitive edge, it can qualify as a trade secret under both the Uniform Trade Secret Act and the DTSA. So, on the other hand, publicly available information, what we call scratch the surface information, is not going to be a trade secret. If you see it in a tweet or a social media post, that's not going to be a trade secret. If the Wall Street Journal reports on it, that's not going to be a trade secret. If it's information that someone can find from somewhere else, be it a message board or extracted from other public available information, a court is not going to recognize that information as a trade secret. So by way of example, there's a recent case at the end of last year called Ipox-Schuster, the Nico Asset Management Company. And what this case involved was the plaintiff was the creator of an actual index, and the defendant was someone that created a fund based on that index. And the creator sued the fund creator, alleging that they based their fund on the plaintiff's trade secrets. And what's interesting about this case is it covers a lot of the issues that come up in trade secret litigation. So the plaintiff was a company of only a handful of employees, and it designated, and so what the court was forced to look at was, were reasonable steps taken to protect the information. In this case, the plaintiff marked some information as confidential in a footer, but otherwise freely disclosed information to the defendant. The court denied summary judgment to both parties and said, you know, it's going to be a question of fact because the court could see it both ways. But given the fact that it was such a small company, whether it was reasonable under the circumstances that they just designate information as confidential was an issue of fact. Another interesting point is that the defendant, some of the defendants were Japan-based, and the court said that the Illinois Trade Secret Act, which is Illinois' version of the Uniform Trade Secret Act, had application outside of Illinois, and that if a party misappropriates trade secrets from an Illinois company, they can be liable under the Illinois Trade Secret Act, regardless of where they're domiciled. And as well, the court said that whether the defendants engaged in intentional misappropriation or conscious disregard of the plaintiff's rights was a question of fact as to whether punitive damages were available. So in another recent case, Mission Measurement Company Corporation versus Blackbaud, this was a motion to dismiss case or opinion, and the court found that what is required to be pled under both the Defend Trade Secret Act and the Illinois Trade Secret Act was substantially similar, and the defendant challenged what were the pleading obligations of the plaintiff in terms of what detail is required to allege in the existence of a trade secret. Court here said, you know, only a description of the information is required, but a party doesn't need to actually describe in detail what that trade secret is because that would result in disclosure of the information, and that's not required. So basic description is sufficient to sustain a trade secret claim under both the DTSA and the Illinois Trade Secret Act. So we've also listed a handful of other cases here that are of interest in the trade secret and financial services industry that may be of further interest. But next I'm going to turn it over to Eric, and we're going to talk about practical steps to keep trade secret information confidential.
Thanks, Marcus. Before I get started, I'm going to announce the CLE code. So make sure you take this down to get credit. It's SS, as in Seyfarth Shaw, 1252. That's SS 1252. As Marcus mentioned, and should be pretty obvious to everyone listening, in order for a trade secret to be a secret, it must be kept a secret. Supreme Court has held that public disclosure of a trade secret destroys the information status as a trade secret, and this is a pretty basic tenet of trade secret law for obvious reasons. Now, of course, the devil's in the detail with respect to what that actually means and what you have to do to maintain that secrecy, and that's what we're going to talk about in this next section. So what level of security is required in order to maintain your trade secrets as secrets? Absolute secrecy and heroic measures are not required. The only thing that matters is what's reasonable under the circumstances, as Marcus mentioned. And that means what's reasonable in the context of your business, of your industry, in the size of your company, and so on and so forth. So, for instance, a defense contractor or Coca-Cola is going to take much more stringent precautions and have much stronger security measures in place than a mom-and-pop shop, and obviously anywhere in between the levels of security that need to be taken are going to vary. And it's a very fact-intensive inquiry, and really you've just got to think about if you had to present to the court what precautions you took, what would the court consider to be reasonable under the circumstances? And if you're comfortable with what you're doing, if you work with outside counsel who has experience in this type of matter, and they're comfortable with what you're doing, then you should be all set. Now, again, it's very fact-intensive, so different judges will rule different ways, but you really just need to think of it in terms of being reasonable. The most important thing I would suggest is prevention protocols. We'll discuss those in the upcoming slides, but if they're effective, you can avoid a lot of headaches down the road in terms of what to do when somebody does take your information. If you're preventing it from happening in most instances or in every instance, then obviously you're far better off. That being said, if a trade secret is leaked or is disclosed improperly and you don't try to fix it or you don't try to minimize the damage, then your value to the company of that trade secret may be compromised and lost forever. And that means you have to actually enforce agreements, policies, and the like. You can't just have them on the books. That's not going to be good enough. You've actually got to enforce them. Or you may end up being held later when you really do want to enforce it that you've waived those rights. And again, courts will carefully scrutinize whether you took appropriate steps to safeguard your security. And again, as I said earlier, this is what's reasonable in your company, in your industry, and consider the story that you'd like to tell to the court. Because that's what's going to happen if you get involved in litigation, is you're going to be telling a story to the court, and it's got to be a reasonable story. So as far as best practices for protecting your information goes, we've got this little mnemonic, ACE. The first thing is an audit, and it's very helpful, can be very helpful for determining what you have in terms of trade secrets, how you're currently protecting them, if at all, and whether that's adequate, and what you could be doing better. Now, there's actually an active debate going on in the trade secrets bar right now about whether you should have a trade secret register or a list or a Excel spreadsheet of all of your trade secrets and where they're stored and whatnot and what they are. Some folks will say absolutely you need to have that in order to know what you're protecting and to be able to describe that to the court if and when it comes time and to describe to your employees who have access to it that that is in fact a trade secret. Others are hesitant to do this because, you know, it could potentially be a discoverable document, and there's always the risk that you leave something off unintentionally or you forget to update it or you don't update it as regularly as you should, and all of a sudden you've got this list that says what your trade secrets are, what your employee or your vendor or whoever took isn't on there. Is that going to be held against you? Again, that's an active debate going on, and there's folks on both sides of it. But an audit is, regardless of whether you're going to keep a trade secret register, an audit is very helpful, and it's something that law firms like Seyfarth Shaw offer. And I'll give you a shameless plug here that we're actually putting together an audit program specifically targeted to the financial services companies and financial services industry that we're going to be rolling out this year. And you'll hear more about that on our blog and through emails. The second issue, best practice that I'll talk about on the next slide, is creating a culture of confidentiality. It's very important. And then, of course, enforcement of agreements, policies, legal requirements, and so on is of course key, and it's critical to maintaining your trade secrets. Now, one of the most important things, and it's not necessarily something that a lot of folks think about, is what's your culture of confidentiality at your company? You know, we all think about agreements that we have in place, and we make sure our policies are up to date and that we're complying with industry norms and laws, but we don't always think about what the culture is at the office. And that's critically important because more often than not, if somebody's taking your trade secret, you know, you read in the newspaper about the Chinese and the Russians hacking and, you know, whoever else, but more often than not, it's employees, either intentionally or unintentionally, walking off with your trade secrets, and that's where you really, that's the front line of defense. So what you need to do, I'd suggest, is that you need to ensure employees understand what the company considers to be confidential and why it's important to maintain that confidentiality. Now, what is confidential? You need to set that forth either in broad strokes, depending on your company, or specific types of information or specific documents or specific databases. And whoever has access to it needs to know that the company considers that a trade secret. And they need to be given that information, both to set expectations and so that later down the road, if they're confused or if they do something and take the information, then of course they can't claim that they were never told that was a trade secret. You also should describe why it's being treated as confidential. You know, we're not suggesting that you have a culture, we're certainly not suggesting you have a culture of like a big brother atmosphere here. And you need to describe that to your employees. We're not doing this so that we can watch you or so that we can prohibit you from doing your job. What we're doing is we're protecting the company's information, and you should tie it in with client service and client expectations, especially in an industry like financial services, where there are industry norms and there are laws requiring that you keep certain things confidential. And also, being in a service industry, you've got to keep your clients happy or they're going to go elsewhere. And if there's a newspaper article on the cover of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal that says, you know, somebody just walked off with your customer list or all sorts of financial information about your clients or your target, the targets you're going after, then that's going to hurt you from a business perspective, leaving aside the legal ramifications of it. And make it clear to the employees how it is you're protecting it. If they're on a list of people with a need to know, make that clear to them that this information isn't accessible to everybody in the company, and you shouldn't be talking about it with folks who are not on the list of the need to know. And give them a sense of ownership over it. I would suggest that people tend to protect more information more stringently when they feel like it's part of their job and it's something that's expected of them and it's something that they have a role in doing in protecting the security of the company. It's not just something that management's telling them they have to do, but it's actually something that they want to do because it's going to enhance your product or your service offerings. Another way to create a culture of confidentiality is the golden rule, to treat others how you would like to be treated. And by that I mean when you're onboarding new employees, even in your offer letters, you should be making it clear to them that you are not interested in the confidential information of their prior employers or prior companies that they may have done work on behalf of. And again, this sets the tone really early that not only are you an upstanding company, but this is going to be the expectations for them with respect to your information as well. Include this in policies. Have policies that say, you know, if you learn information from clients and vendors that you shouldn't be disclosing, you can't disclose that. That's not your information to disclose. That's our client's information. That's our vendor's information, so on and so forth. And in employment agreements, if you have them, include that an expectation of their employment is that they're not going to disclose confidential information of their prior employers to you, and that's frankly a basis for termination if they do so. And again, we'll talk about this, but you've got to enforce these things as well. You should provide training modules with examples of do's and don'ts. I'm not suggesting that you have to dumb this down. You know, your employees are very smart people, very sophisticated people, but giving examples is helpful. People think in different ways. Some people are visual. Some people learn more when they hear something. Some people need examples. Some people would prefer kind of more vague description, not vague, but higher level descriptions of what it is. And in those trainings, you should identify industry standards and legal requirements that are out there, in addition to, of course, your agreements and your own company policies. Now, again, the timing, the amount of training, what's included in those trainings will depend on the size and the type of company you are and what types of information that you may have. Again, a government contractor is going to have a different that's working in the defense industry is going to have different requirements than a financial services company, for instance. And again, the standard is what's reasonable under the circumstances. It's not going to be one size fits all. You should mark things confidential and proprietary if they are, in fact, confidential and proprietary. Now, that being said, doing this is neither sufficient nor is it necessary. Something, if you treat it as confidential in every other way, it's not going to lose its confidentiality just because you don't mark it confidential. And on the flip side, if something is not confidential, just by stamping it confidential isn't going to make it so. But that being said, it's very helpful in a number of ways. It reminds employees that they've got these obligations. It specifically calls out this document or this database or whatever it is as being something that falls within your policies and that needs to be protected. And then later, if you end up in court, it's one more piece of the puzzle that you can show when you're telling your story. And you can say that the documents they took not only were treated as confidential, but when they emailed them to themselves, they had a disclaimer on the bottom that said this is confidential information. It's really hard to argue against that. And you should make any security protocols easy to understand, familiar, and uniform. That goes for all your policies, your procedures, and again, enforcement. If you need to be consistent, and it needs to be clear if you want people to follow these. And again, you can have all the policies in the world, But if you're not enforcing them, you're going to have an issue because once the cat's out of the bag with a trade secret, as we learned on the first slide, there's no way to get that back. So specific measures to protect trade secrecy should include agreements with employees. Again, offer letters. It's the perfect opportunity to say, we don't want your prior employer's information, and we don't want you to touch our information. And again, I think that sets expectations, and it also sets the culture of the company as one that's doing the right thing here and has expectations for a reason. Other types of agreements are non-disclosure agreements, agreements that require employees to return materials at the end of a process. Of them and that you're going to enforce these things. Another measure is employee policies and handbooks. This includes not only confidentiality provisions and policies, but also privacy, bring your own device or BYOD policies, access policies, who has access to what and what types of password protections you need. Social media policies are very important, especially this day and age when social media is such a big thing. People will put stuff up there that's not necessarily, they're not necessarily thinking that they're disclosing a trade secret. Maybe they're just bragging on a social media platform that they're working on this really cool project, but that really cool project may be secret. So you've got to make it clear what employees can and cannot do on social media. And if it is a problem in your company or if you have a younger workforce, you know, you've got to do some monitoring of that as well. And also policies related to overseas travel. If you talk to the FBI folks who deal with this, they'll tell you that as soon as you get off a plane in certain countries, you should assume if you're in a certain industry, your computer or your phone has been hacked into and that they've got everything on there. So what are your policies? Do you need to bring burner phones, computers with blank hard drives, computers that you can leave behind if necessary? All of these things should be thought out ahead of time so that you're not dealing with it at customs in a country that may be hostile or have hostile people working within it. And for all policies, whether they're all in the employee handbook or they're separate policies that are given out at different times, you should include certifications that the employees received and reviewed them. Again, it's not necessary, but it does. It is helpful if there's litigation. It's another tool in the toolbox in terms of saying, you know, the employee can no longer say, well, I didn't get that policy. That, you know, I had to search all over the intranet for it. Well, no, you signed this document or you electronically signed this document saying that you'd reviewed it and gone through it all. So that's another helpful tool. In addition to employees, you've got to be concerned or at least protect yourself with respect to third parties, such as clients, vendors, contractors, suppliers, joint venture partners, and this would include your law firms. A major source of a major target for hackers these days is law firms, and you've got to make sure that your law firm and whatever other vendors you have policies in place and are agreeing to be bound by your policies. As soon as you pass information to a third party, you know, it becomes vulnerable. You need to understand what your vendor's policies and procedures and security protocols are. And then finally, you know, you actually have to have a secure network and facility. And what that means is, again, it has to be reasonable under the circumstances. Password protections, is that one password to log in the morning, or is that one password to log in the morning and a separate one to get into your email and a third one to get into the client database or the, you know, the working files for whatever project it is you're working on. Again, that'll depend on your company. Need to know distribution of materials. There's typically no reason that everybody in the company needs to see every document, and that there are certain people, whether they're salespeople or engineers, who do need to see those things, and it should be limited to folks who need to see it. Because, again, you're going to have to explain to the court what it is you did to take these precautions. Lock and key for hard copy documents. You shouldn't just have filing cabinets out in the open that have these sensitive information that a cleaning person could go into or a customer or an employee if they shouldn't have access to it. And then monitoring tools, both in real time and after the fact. After the fact, you can hire somebody to come in or your IT department may be able to do it to see what type of printing activity had been done or downloading activity. But also, there are tools you can get where while the employees are still there before they leave, if there's a major download that's not expected, it'll set up a red flag for you, or if there's some major printing activity. And that doesn't mean you fire the person. It just means you go and you investigate it and maybe talk to the person about what they were doing. And, it may be that it was completely innocuous, but, it's something that you need to maintain you need to monitor. Again, burner phones and devices for overseas travel if that's necessary. And really, at the bottom line is you just need to know your vulnerabilities. And firms like ours can certainly help you. And again, the audit is a perfect way to understand what your vulnerabilities are in that regard. With respect to protection against the rogue or sloppy employee, and this slide frankly applies to vendors and other third parties as well who are given access to your information, even with a great culture of compliance, even if you're doing everything that's been on the previous slides, there's always going to be an employee who's sloppy or who has bad intentions. And going back to the culture is more than just having folks understand what their obligations are, although that's certainly important. But employees who are happy and feel like they're part of something and feel like they're have ownership are typically going to treat your information better than somebody who doesn't feel any of those things, and frankly, somebody who's either looking to leave or looking to hurt you as a company. So some tips for this are limiting access to a need-to-know basis we've talked about, limiting access to non-approved cloud solutions. It's an easy way for hackers to get in, or for people to be storing stuff on something that's less secure than your own systems. Again, monitoring, conducting exit interviews is important, and also, again, onboarding, the golden rule, letting people know right up front that this is your culture, and then when they leave, letting them know what your expectations are. Collect and secure materials of terminated employees, whether it's their laptop or their computer at their desk or their phone. Don't automatically repurpose a phone or a computer if there's a concern that this employee may have taken off with something. And then send reminders when appropriate, whether that's during employment. Here's a reminder about our policies. We want you to sign again that you've read them, or afterwards, it's either a cease and desist letter or a letter that's a little bit tamer that just says, hey, we just want to remind you of your obligations. You're not allowed to disclose this information. And again, make sure that anybody outside of your company, law firms, vendors, so on and so forth, who had access to your trade secrets, make sure they have similar protections in place. In the event of theft, loss, or breach, you should secure the information and assess the damage. Law firms can help you with this, like ours. Forensic imaging companies can help you. Your IT department, your in-house legal department should all be on the same page about when an employee leaves. A, you cut them off of any IT access they have, and then if there is a concern, set up the protocols so that you can see what they've done and put an end to the damage. Again, sending cease and desist letters, enforcing agreements, pursuing legal action to enforce rights. We'll talk about that on the next slide. And if it's super egregious, may consider calling the FBI to get involved. And they have a department that's dedicated to protecting companies' trade secrets, and they're more than happy to come out and give trainings and also to help you if there's an issue. You need to determine whether client or individual notice is required under state and federal breach notification laws. You might notify insurers if it's appropriate, and you should think about your company procedures and agreements and policies and say, is there something we could have done better and that we can do better next time? And, of course, if litigation is reasonably on the horizon, you need to preserve evidence, both to prove your case and also because, frankly, you have a legal obligation to do so. So in terms of legal options, you can sue if somebody takes your – if it's an employee or a vendor who takes your information, you can sue for breach of contract if you have contracts in place, or there's other civil claims that you can bring. Marcus described the Defend Trade Secrets Act, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. There's also the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, claims for breach of fiduciary duty or duty of loyalty, depending on the employee. And there's other state law misappropriation claims and Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Acts. Again, as Marcus mentioned, consider getting injunctive relief to put an end to it immediately. Consider expedited discovery either in conjunction with injunctive relief or separate before you go in for injunctive relief. And in very limited cases, you can ask for an ex parte seizure order under the Defend Trade Secrets Act if you think that the employee or the vendor is going to go overseas and take the information with them, for instance. I won't get into all the different types of damages. Marcus did that to some degree, and that could be an entire webinar. But again, you could potentially recover your attorney's fees in certain circumstances under the DTSA, UTSA, and other statutes. And also, you should include an attorney's fees provision in your agreements with your employees and vendors. And then, again, if it's particularly egregious, you should consider a criminal referral. There are criminal statutes that would govern theft of trade secrets, including the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the Economic Espionage Act. And, you know, one suggestion that we typically have is work with your outside counsel to put together a package for the FBI. It's much easier to do that, to get the FBI's attention, A, if it's a lot of money at stake, B, if there's foreign actors involved, but C, if you do a lot of the work for them. And we've done that for clients numerous times, and I would suggest that it's more helpful to the FBI than not. And then, of course, in addition to more punitive measures taken against the bad guys in a criminal context like jail, you can get forfeiture and restitution as well. So you're not necessarily giving up the right to recover your losses. It's just the government's going after it, either in conjunction with a civil lawsuit or in lieu of one. And with that, I will turn it over to Scott.
Thanks, Eric. So the last part of this webinar is focused on the interplay between FINRA and the court system with respect to confidential information. And it really starts with two rules, 13804 and 13209. And we won't go into detail and read them to you, but there's a couple highlights that you should be aware of. One, and this happens a lot, especially with attorneys that aren't as used to dealing with the interplay between the court system and FINRA, and that is, they usually just go straight to FINRA. They say, hey, listen, this is a dispute between two brokers. Both are registered with FINRA, are two member firms of FINRA. Therefore, I have to go to FINRA. And that's not accurate. What Rule 13804 and 13209 specifically allow you to do is they allow you to go seek court intervention first. And especially if you have an arbitration clause in your agreements, that specifically remind everyone that they have to go to FINRA and that it's governed by FINRA rules. Even with that clause, you're complying with FINRA rules if you first go and seek an injunction. But it's not a permanent injunction, and it's not even a preliminary injunction necessarily. What the FINRA rules allow for is what's called a, quote, temporary injunction. And what most people assume that means is a temporary restraining order, so that you can go in, get your temporary restraining order, barring someone from using your confidential information or from soliciting their former clients, and then you go to FINRA. But what there has been some case law and some pushback on in recent years is that, you know, temporary injunction could also mean preliminary injunction, and therefore you're allowed to do some discovery, most notably a deposition, because as we've talked about, or we will talk about, excuse me, in a few moments, in the court system, you're allowed to take full discovery, and that includes depositions. FINRA, the rules specifically prohibit depositions except for very limited circumstances, usually the unavailability of a witness or if there's a medical condition. So some firms have been pushing the envelope on this with some success. Others have not had success of telling a court temporary means preliminary. Therefore, we should be allowed to do expedited discovery, Your Honor, before we go to FINRA. But regardless of whether your judge allows you to do some sort of preliminary discovery before a temporary injunction hearing, you're going to wind up with FINRA anyway, and you're going to wind up in FINRA after you receive that court order from the judge, because under Rule 13209, after you have an order from the judge that either grants injunctive relief, denies injunctive relief, or somewhere in between, gives you some of what you want but not all of it, you then have to go in front of FINRA, and FINRA convenes an emergency panel, decide whether or not they're going to follow the court ruling. More often than not, the FINRA panel follows the court ruling, but they don't have to. They can modify the order. So let's say that you have a injunction that says you will not contact any customers. They could change that and say you will not solicit any customers. Though this is rare and candidly I haven't seen it happen, they could increase the scope of the injunction. or they can say, I like this as it is, and we're just going to keep it in place, which is most often the end result. A couple other rules that you have to be aware of are 11870 and 2140, and this deals with preventing account transfers. The short answer is, under FINRA rules, you can't do that. So once the customer has left, once the customer's filled out the ACAT form, you have to let them go. Neither a court of law nor the FINRA arbitration panel will order those customers back to you. However, if you read the subsections of 21400 and more importantly the commentaries, you will see that it specifically states that you can recover monetary damages as a result of losing those customers if there's a violation of a restrictive covenant or violation of a confidentiality provision. Also, what you should also be aware of is that some people will try to say, well, because of Rule 2140 saying that you can't prevent account transfer, that means I'm allowed to solicit my customers despite whether or not I have a restrictive covenant agreement. The commentaries of 2140 specifically say that that is wrong, and that that is not what the rule is designed to do, and that's not how the rules should be interpreted. If you have a restrictive covenant agreement, they expect you to honor it. What 2140 simply says is if you don't catch them in time and the customer ends up leaving, you cannot order the customer back. All you can get is monetary damages. And then the last rule is 2273, which went into effect 2 years ago this week. And what that has done is it has created a form that all FINRA firms are required to send out to their customers when that customer wants to transfer assets. And what you're starting to see in some settings with some firms is that they are taking an aggressive approach where they say, hey, Rule 2273 says I got to send out this disclosure form, therefore it's not a solicitation. But if you read the rule actually says that you only need to send out that informational piece, which talks about things that a individual should consider when they are switching firms. If you read that language, it specifically says that it's only supposed to be used and that form is only supposed to be sent when an individual is contacted to transfer assets. And so, you know, what you're also seeing here and what I think has been the prevailing, you know, view is that that's a solicitation. You know, is that if you're reaching out to somebody and you're sending Rule 2273, the only reason why under Rule 2273 that you're doing that is because you are contacting them to transfer assets. And so those are things that you need to be considered and continue to consider as this law continues to develop and as both FINRA and the judicial system grapple with these issues and continue to expand written opinions on it. The other thing to now think about is, okay, what are the key differences between being in court and FINRA? You know, the obviously ones are court's more formal. You get full discovery. You get interrogatories. You get document requests. You get third-party subpoenas. You get depositions. You can get full injunctive relief. FINRA is less formal. It's more along the lines of the wild, wild west. You know, you have certain requirements that you have to comply with, certain things you have to produce. But other than that, it's not nearly as robust, and you don't nearly have the mechanisms and tools in your toolbox in a FINRA litigation that you have in court if you're dealing with somebody who isn't being as, we'll say, responsive as they should be to discovery. Similarly, in, you know, following along with that is you have federal rules of evidence that have to be complied with at an injunction hearing, have to be complied with at trial. There are no rules of evidence when it comes to FINRA arbitration. In fact, the FINRA rules specifically say that the rules of evidence do not apply, which means that you have to deal with what the three arbitration panel wants you to deal with. And sometimes on arbitration panels, you only have one lawyer who might not even be a practicing lawyer, or you might get all three who are just industry representatives who don't have a sufficient legal background with respect to discovery issues. You have to take that into, and you have to consider that when you're creating your case, when you're deciding whether to go straight to FINRA or go into court first. You have to consider all of those things because that relationship and that knowledge will impact what you want to do and how you want to do it. And then the last line here that you'll see, or the last row, damages. And Eric touched on this a little bit, and he's right when you say this could be a totally another webinar. But one of the things is that you have to look at is, okay, courts, I can look at case law. I can look at other cases. I can see, you know, damages. You know, I'm going to be in front of a jury. And you have, you know, jury instructions that jurors are supposed to follow, and most times do follow. For arbitrations, it can be arbitrator justice. They can split the baby, whereas a judge can make a ruling that can affect what amount, if any, damages you can recover, and that's based upon legal precedent. Here, arbitrators get to decide, and arbitrators get to do what they want to do. And unless you can show that an arbitrator was paid off, or that there was some sort of fraud, or that you didn't, you know, you weren't able to, you know, present your case to the arbitration panel, that decision is final, absolute, and binding upon the parties. So those are the things that you need to consider when you're strategizing, hey, what do I do in this situation? Where should I go first? Should I go defend, or should I go to court? Where is the better, given the circumstances and the lay of the land as I know them now, where am I best off being? And that leads to the final thing that we're going to talk about, and that's the protocol for broker recruiting, because that has a significant impact on both confidential information and restrictive covenants in the financial services industry. In fact, I think it's fair to say that probably nothing in the last 15 to 20 years has had a larger impact on restrictive covenant enforcement and confidential information protecting than the protocol. So what is it? Well, it started back in 2004, and it started really gaining traction around 2008, 2009, when the market and the economy collapsed. And what it basically is it allows certain individuals, certain brokers, to take certain information with them when they leave their firm. It currently has about 1,200 signatories, and as I said, it's been growing up until this year, but there has been a significant momentum shift, or potential momentum shift, and that people are now starting to shy away from it. And the two big ones both happened in December of 2017 and January of this year. Morgan Stanley and UBS specifically said that they're leaving the protocol. And we'll talk about that potential impact in a little while from now. But that's significant, especially since UBS was one of the founders. And we've started to see some people now moving away from the protocol, and we'll talk about that as well in a few moments. But what you need to know, first off, is that's what it does, and we'll talk about that, or what it allows you to take, and we'll talk about that more in a minute. But it was administered by FINRA and SIFMA. It's now handled by an outside law firm. And to dial it down further, what you're allowed to do is a broker can take names, addresses, telephone numbers, email addresses, and account titles with them if they comply with the protocol requirements. They also can then solicit their firmer clients if they comply with the protocol. And because of that, then naturally, it bars the former firm or employer from seeking damages and injunctive relief if they take this information or if they start soliciting their clients. The issues that have arisen over the years, and you saw this more in 2008, 2009, and 2010, was that you had a lot of people joining the protocol without doing their due diligence to see if they had confidentiality agreements, if they had restrictive covenant agreements, and then how the protocol was going to impact those agreements. Because what happens is you can have a non-compete agreement, but if you've signed on to the protocol, you cannot enforce it, because the protocol specifically says, hey, you can take this confidential information, you can solicit these clients as long as, you know, you're going to a protocol member firm. And because of that, and because of the traction that the protocol's gotten, that caused movement and caused a lot of what firms thought to be confidential information walk out the door. And if you read the press releases from UBS and Morgan Stanley, part of the reason why they are doing what they're doing and have left the protocol is because they want to start enforcing their restrictive covenant agreements, and they want to start protecting their confidential information, such as client names, addresses, and telephone numbers. So then the question becomes is, okay, well, what's the litigation landscape with respect to protocol and non-protocol firms? And not surprisingly, it's pretty much developed into three categories. Situation where the plaintiff and the defendant are both members of the protocol, situations where the plaintiff is a member of the protocol and the defendant is not, and vice versa, where the plaintiff is a non-signatory to the protocol, but the defendant is. And the easiest one is the plaintiff and defendant are both being members of the protocol. There, you really just look at the 8-page protocol. You see if the if they complied with its requirements, such as leaving a list of the customer information that they've taken with them, with their boss, if they have, you know, taken the steps of not taking anything else with them. It's a relatively clean and surgical analysis. Where it gets more dicey is then if you have a signatory plaintiff and a non-signatory defendant. In these situations, what the cases have said is that, listen, signatory plaintiff, by signing on to the protocol, you have told us that you do not believe that you have a legitimate business interest in these, in this information that they've taken with them, the customer names, the customer address, and you have told us that you do not have a legitimate business interest in enforcing your restrictive covenants because you've told people, hey, you can go ahead and take this. Because you have done that, the fact that the defendant is not a member of the protocol is irrelevant in the eyes of the court. And courts have been consistent in not enforcing restrictive covenants signed by plaintiff signatory firms against individuals that leave and go to a non-signatory firm, because what they've said is, listen, if you say that this isn't a business interest worthy of protection with respect to a protocol firm, it can't then be an interest worthy of protection and restrictive covenant enforcement against a non-protocol firm. And one of the things that will be interesting now to see, and that we, the three of us, Eric, Marcus, and myself, will continue to monitor, is to see if the fact that you have once belonged to the protocol, if that will impact your ability going forward to enforce restrictive covenants and confidentiality restrictions. In other words, you know, is this heavy defense lawyer going to say, well, wait a minute, for all these years you said that this stuff wasn't a protectable business interest, you can't now change your footing, or what is the reason why you've changed your footing and position on this position? It's going to be an interesting argument, and it's going to make for some interesting debates both before a FINRA panel and the court over the next, you know, several months as well as next couple of years. So then the final situation is where you have a non-signatory plaintiff going up and filing a lawsuit against individuals that have joined a signatory firm. And in that situation, the courts have consistently said, listen, if the plaintiff is not part of the protocol, then the protocol doesn't apply, and we're not even going to look at, we're not even going to consider, we're just rather going to look and see, are the restrictions reasonable, are they enforceable under the relevant state law, and we're going to go from there. And the FINRA arbitrators have, you know, typically followed suit as well. Now, from time to time, if you're in a FINRA arbitration more likely than in court, you sometimes will hear an argument made by a defendant whose firm is a member of the protocol, that the protocol is the, quote, industry standard. That's the phrase that gets used. And I've yet to see that, you know, quote, industry standard argument gain any traction. It definitely hasn't gotten any traction in the courts, but you will sometimes see, again, because it's the wild, wild west, arbitrator justice, a FINRA, you know, defendant who's a member of a protocol firm say, hey, look, this is the situation. We do not have, you know, an agreement between ourselves, but this is standard practice, this is standard industry practice, and that's just simply not the case, and there's several defenses. You know, you look at all the other thousands who are not members of it, you still talk about the steps that you take to protect your business interests that you can use to overcome that. What this also means, and moving down further, is you have to look at your company agreements if you want to join the protocol and see what their impact is, as well as if you're leaving the protocol now and say, okay, how is this going to change how we enforce restrictive covenants? How is this going to change the protocol, or how is this going to change our internal protocols with respect to protecting confidential information? And obviously the last bullet point here that you always need to think about is if you are in a merger or acquisition, either being the merger or and the acquirer or the acquiree, you know, who has what agreements, and is anybody a member of the protocol? Because if they are, you need to be careful in your in documenting your transaction as to whether or not those agreements, those protocol representations, are going to carry over into the new firm. So with that, and I realize we're almost out of time, the one and probably the most important takeaway is from one of our founding fathers, Ben Franklin, and that is, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that is, you want to address trade secret protection before the information is taken, not after a crisis situation arises. And this goes back to what Eric mentioned earlier about trade secret audits and doing things like that. The reason why is, yes, you will have to hire outside counsel to do some of these things, these precautionary things, but that price that you pay to get everything ready and to get everything protected is a far less minor cost than when you get into these things and you're spending $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $100,000, you know, upwards, you know, into the six figures to defend a trade secret non-compete case. That cost is always more significant, 10 times more significant than what it costs you to take those steps to prepare so that your confidential information is protected, so that you're ready in the event that something happens to enforce your restrictive covenants. And so with that, we will pause just for a minute to take one or two questions if we have time. Otherwise, to those of you who have submitted questions, and there's several of you, so we thank you for that, and we thank you for taking the time, this hour of your day to spend with us. We will reach out to you individually to make sure that everyone's questions are answered. So with that, let us pause for just a minute. So we've been told we can take one question, and we'll try to make it as fast as we can. And the question is how do you recommend maintaining the standard with independent contractors? So a couple things. One, obviously, you know, in a labor and employment setting, an independent contractor versus an employee is a very important distinguishing factor. In the trade secret non-compete setting, it isn't so much. You know, what the courts will look at is not so much are they an independent contractor or an employee. You know, that does get, you know, some lip service. But what they typically focus on is what is the legitimate business interest that's being protected. And, you know, with respect to independent contractors, what steps are you taking with respect to that independent contractor's access to confidential information? Are you limiting that information to just the independent contractor? You know, are you giving him or her only the information that they need to perform that service? Or are you allowing everybody to have access to that confidential information in your firm, whether it's an independent contractor or an employee? Some of the restrictive covenants, it goes back to that legitimate business interest. Are you enforcing this restrictive covenant against this independent contractor or this employee, for that matter, because you need it to protect your client base, to protect client information, to protect confidential information? That's the focus. So when you're doing your audit or when you're doing, going to enforce a restrictive covenant, what you want to first focus on is not so much on the independent contractor or employee definition, but rather the confidential information that you need protected. Who gets it? Is it something that they only need to do their work? Are you password protecting it? Are you requiring logins if it's electronic? Are you doing steps to make sure that it's being electronically filed or followed so that if somebody tries to download it to a flash drive, you get a ping to let you know? Or if they're trying to, you know, send it to an outside source, such as a Gmail account, that's something you would know. Some of the restrictive covenants. Is this a legitimate, what is your legitimate business interest? For example, is it customer relationships, which is a legitimate business interest? Okay, you know, is your restriction reasonable? Does it comply with the state law that they're in? Things like that, that's what you want to focus on. And so with that, again, you know, thank you very, Eric, Marcus, and I thank you for your time. If there are any additional questions, you will see here our email and contact information. Please, you know, don't hesitate at all to reach out to any one of us. We're happy to answer any questions you have. And you can always follow us as well as the SafeR, you know, Trade Secret and Non-Compete group on our blog, tradesecretslaw.com. And with that, have a good day, everyone.
This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.